Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in American Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James West, and today I'm joined by Nicholas Bucola, a political science professor at Linfield College. The subject of our conversation today is Nick's new book, The Fire is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America, out this month from Princeton University Press. Based around the iconic debate between Baldwin and Buckley, which took place at Cambridge Union in 1965, Bucola takes this moment as a point of entry into the intellectual trajectories of his two protagonists and their place within the broader cultural and political history of post-war civil rights activism and the rise of the modern conservative movement in the United States. Hey Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, James. How are you?
I'm not too bad. So today we're going to be talking about your new book, The Fire is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America. To start off with, can you say a little bit about how you came to the project, what the origins of this project were, how easy or hard the process was from that first idea to the finished product?
Yeah, so I came to this project through Baldwin. I was invited to write an essay about Baldwin way back in maybe 2012, and I actually didn't know Baldwin's work all that well when I started that project. And I started out by reading everything I possibly could that James Baldwin had written, and I, in that process, discovered just messing around the internet the debate with Buckley, which I think it was somewhere on my radar, but not something I had really examined closely. And I immediately became kind of mesmerized by the debate. It just seemed like such a dramatic and important moment where you have these, you know, two figures who are so dramatically different, clashing over, you know, the central issue of civil rights and also just sort of race and the American dream. And so I began by writing the essay I had been invited to write for the Political Companion to James Baldwin. I used the Buckley-Baldwin debate as a kind of framing device in that essay, which was about Baldwin's theory of freedom. And as I worked on the essay, I kept thinking, there's a book in here. And at first, I thought maybe a shorter book about, you know, Baldwin's trip to Cambridge. There have been a couple books that had come out about Malcolm X traveling to Oxford in 1964. And I thought maybe I'll do something that's sort of focused on the debate and, you know, how Baldwin got there and so on. And then as I dug into the project, I thought there's a bigger book here. Baldwin and Buckley were born about a year apart from each other, Baldwin in 1924, Buckley in 1925. And so they're almost exact contemporaries. They come of age intellectually at about the same moment, late 40s, early 50s. And they reach the, you know, the prime of their career at this exact same moment in the 60s. And so I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to think about Baldwin and Buckley, do an intellectual, joint intellectual biography set against the backdrop of the rise of the civil rights and conservative movements. And so that's kind of how the project got going in my mind. And then once I kind of had that vision, the process of putting the book together was one that included a lot of, you know, methodologies that were kind of new to me. I'm used to writing about the 19th century, so mostly, you know, reading old books and digging in archives, and that was certainly part of this process. But I also had the opportunity to interview some of the folks who hosted the debate, so the Cambridge students, you know, who hosted them in 65. Fortunately, many of those folks are still with us, you know, in their 70s. So my undergraduate students at Linfield College and I set out to track these folks down, as many of them as we could, and I interviewed them for the project. So that was another really important part of piecing the story of how the debate happened together, and then sort of combining that with this archival work and intellectual history work I was doing.
That sounds really interesting. Could you say a bit more about the interviews that you did? I mean, how many people were you able to track down? Was there kind of a consensus over that, how they remembered the debate, or was there a bit of variation?
Yeah, that was really fascinating. It was very frustrating at first to find, you know, as we set out to try to find folks. I mean, partially because that was kind of a new challenge for me as a researcher, but my students proved to be especially helpful in that regard. And we found one particular student, a guy named Christy Davies, who was a British academic, a sociologist, who had this really, really interesting, you know, story in his own right, because he was not only present for the Baldwin-Buckley debate in 65, but he actually participated in the Oxford debate with Malcolm X in 1964. He was invited to Cambridge and Oxford, sort of do this exchange thing where they would invite the debaters from the other school to participate in these big keynote debates. And so Christy, once we found Christy, he was sort of the key figure because he helped us find everybody else. I spent probably about 3 hours on the phone with Christy interviewing him about the debate, but also he was just, you know, there on his computer giving me email addresses and phone numbers of people that he still was in touch with. And so, yeah, I would say also, you know, just between, you know, correspondence and phone interviews, probably, you know, I ended up talking with about 10 folks that were there and participated in one way or another. And then, of course, interviewed a bunch of living people who knew Baldwin and or Buckley over the course of their lives. So yeah, that was a really, really interesting part of the process for me as a political theorist, you know, / intellectual historian, to actually have living people to speak with. And it was in terms of epistemology and sort of questions of like of memory, that was also very fascinating to see, you know, kind of how people remembered different aspects of what happened that night. And so there was, you know, it was a challenge to sort of figure out, okay, well, this is how this person remembered, you know, subjectively, you know, their role. And this is how, you know, kind of what the historical record indicates to me. So, yeah, that was a really, really cool part of the process. And I think it enriches the narrative in the book in a lot of ways.
You also mentioned digging around in the archives. Were there particular archives that were really central to this project? Maybe a few unexpected detours along the way?
Yeah. The archival work for this book was really incredibly rewarding. It was so William F. Buckley has a very extensive archive at Yale University. And one of the really cool things about this project is that Baldwin and Buckley were both so prolific, not only in their sort of public writing, but also just sort of private writing, and Buckley especially. And so you really, as a researcher, have this, you know, sort of, you're able to peer into their minds almost every day. And as you're, you know, as I'm going through and recounting this really dramatic political history, right, every day, you know, 1963, 1964, there's just every day there's something, you know, just incredibly important happening in the civil rights revolution and also in the rise of the conservative movement. And so through this archival work, by looking at the Buckley papers especially, I'm able to kind of really see how privately Buckley is thinking about some of these things and how he's presenting his views publicly. Baldwin, when I started the project, Baldwin's papers were, you know, not available. And so in 2017, when I was in the middle of working on the book, is when Baldwin's papers were basically in his sister's house, as I understand it, for about 30 years after, you know, Baldwin passed away in 1987. And in 2017, the Schomburg Center for Black Culture in Harlem acquired the papers. And so that was a real, you know, fortuitous thing. I mean, I was very happy, you know, at that point to be able to visit the Schomburg and to check out the Baldwin papers, which are not completely available to researchers. The letters that Baldwin wrote to his younger brother, David, and the letters that he wrote to one, you know, sort of one of his lovers and close friends, Lucien Habsburger, those are not going to be available to researchers till 2037, which was, you know, I was grateful for what I was able to see, because there's a lot of really great material there. I sort of wonder, you know, what's in there, and I suspect there might be some things in there that would be relevant to this project. So I guess in the later edition, I'll add that stuff. But yeah, but in the archival research, I mean, it was fascinating to see, you know, that there's just so many sort of nuggets. It's one of those things, as you know, James, as a researcher, you sort of go in there and there's so much material, and often you spend hours and hours and don't come up with anything. But when those moments hit, when you find something, you know, absolutely breathtaking, it's really powerful. I mean, I guess I can give one example maybe on each side to illustrate that. With Baldwin, there, one really cool thing was I was able to find the handwritten notes that he had prepared on hotel stationery that he brought with him to the Cambridge Union that night, which was really cool. On the Buckley side, I mean, there was a lot of, on the question of race, kind of watching Buckley's mind work behind the scenes was really, I think, the most fascinating thing. So, for example, in 1963, when things are just, you know, as I said before, it seems like every day there's sort of a major event in the civil rights struggle. Buckley essentially, you know, writes this memo to his associate editors and says, you know, I want each of you to prepare a memo, you know, to sort of help me think through what we you know, how we should handle the civil rights struggle. And he's clearly trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, he's been in this position resistance that I'm sure we'll talk about later in the conversation for years, just, you know, opposed to every step of the way, Brown versus Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act, you know, all these different, you know, Civil Rights Act of 1957, you know, the Civil Rights of 1960, he's a critic of the sit-in movement, a critic of the Freedom Riders. And he, you know, he's clearly by 63 trying to sort through, okay, how do we adapt, you know, and still find a position of resistance, but a position of resistance that might be more effective given the change that's occurring. And so being able to sort of look at those interoffice memos at National Review was really, really revealing. And then just one more thing about the archival research that was really helpful was that Baldwin and Buckley both received a lot of fan mail, and that fan mail is available, you know, in the archives of both of them. And so in the aftermath of the Cambridge debate and the second time Buckley and Baldwin met, which was a few months later on a television program called Open End, they met in New York and had a second debate. It was really helpful to see kind of how the audience reaction, you know, to their encounters and sort of how that helped, you know, helped me understand kind of the perception of the events and what happened on those nights.
You mentioned a little bit earlier a couple of other books that have come out that focus on, you know, specific moments or events. So you have, you know, Stephen Tuck's book and Saladin Anbar's book on Malcolm X at Oxford. And you've also had books like Brian Ward, who's a colleague of mine, wrote a book on Martin Luther King's visit to Newcastle in the UK to accept [S2] Right. [S1] A honorary degree. In terms of structuring the narrative of this text, how challenging was it to focus around a single event? I mean, you know, the book is it's a chunky book, so obviously you talk about a lot of other things that aren't just this one debate. But was it challenging? Was it useful? Was it instructive in having this organizing focus of a single event?
Yeah, that was something that I really struggled with early in the project. Is precisely, you know, how to structure the book with this debate being, you know, really the climactic chapter. And so the way I decided to do it, and I hope it worked out okay, but the way I decided to do it was the prologue of the book, really, you know, kind of, it starts with them, you know, kind of walking into the Cambridge Union and the drama of that moment, you know, that February 18th, 1965, not only, you know, as Baldwin and Buckley are eating their pre-debate dinner across the ocean and, you know, Marion, Alabama, outside of Selma, there's a civil rights protest that you know, is the night that Jimmie Lee Jackson is mortally wounded. So there's a kind of way in which I sort of, in that sort of captures these two things happening at the same time, captures the nature of the story that I'm trying to tell in the book, which is simultaneously a kind of intellectual history by way of these two, you know, intellectual biographies of these important public figures, but also a kind of political history of developments in the civil rights movement and in the conservative movement. And so I start with the prologue, and then you know, so after the prologue, we go back in time. And so you sort of go from the prologue to you're there that night at Cambridge in 1965. And then you're back, you know, in the 20s, actually. I have a short chapter. It's not a, you know, biography of the two two men, so I don't provide a lot of detail about their childhoods, but I do try to give the reader a sense of how their upbringings did not determine their views, but helped shape their views. And so to talk a little bit about, you know, the economic circumstances in which Baldwin and Buckley grew up, which were so dramatically different, the families that they grew up in, the sort of intellectual influences that they had as young men. And then the sort of first, you know, big chapter is dealing with Baldwin and Buckley in their early years as kind of making their way onto the intellectual scene. Baldwin by way of his literary criticism and some of his early essays and short fiction, and then Buckley sort of arrives, you know, when he gets to Yale and starts raising hell there in various ways and taking on the institution as a debater and as the managing editor or the chairman, as they call it, of the Yale Daily News, and then eventually writing God and Man at Yale, which is this book-length indictment of the institution for its liberal biases. So, you know, and then the story, basically, the way it's structured is I just sort of weave these stories of Baldwin and Buckley developing intellectually, kind of engaging with their writings, but also engaging with, you know, political events that they're participating in, again, set against this backdrop of the rise of these movements that they play such important roles in shaping. So it's actually kind of the reader is, you know, has to wait about 250 pages before they get back to Cambridge in the debate itself. And so the debate itself constitutes two chapters, two, you know, pretty sizable chapters in the book. And then there's one chapter after the debate that deals with the aftermath. And so 1965, later in 65, all sorts of important things happen, including that second debate between Baldwin and Buckley, which is much less well known. And then Buckley declares his candidacy for mayor of New York City soon after that second meeting. And so, yeah, so then the epilogue, I kind of reflect on the legacies of the debate and thinking about, you know, how Baldwin and Buckley remembered their encounters together and try to draw some lessons for contemporary conversations about racial politics. Once I had the idea of how to structure it, it was, I heard a poet say there's downhill poems and uphill poems, and sort of downhill poems are the ones that kind of write themselves. And this book did not write itself. It was a lot of work. But once I had the idea of the structure, there was so much material to work with and so much, you know, rich history, so much, rich material from these two authors themselves, that it was something that I kind of just, it flowed pretty well. And although it ends up being, it's a big book, I think that there's, it moves at a steady pace because so much is happening that's so important and so relevant to our political lives today.
So you talked a little bit there about Baldwin and Buckley's early lives and the ways in which they were a study of contrasts, but also maybe there are some similarities that we can tease out. One thing that you talk about is their respective relationships to their parents, and in particular their fathers. Could you say a bit more about that and how that might shape their later understanding of activism or of intellectualism or of their position within America?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Baldwin and Buckley, the relationships with their fathers are, you know, so important in understanding their intellectual development early on. So Baldwin is, you know, he grows up in Harlem, born in 1924, as I mentioned before, and his father, David Baldwin, was actually his stepfather, and he says he's the only father I ever knew, so he, you know, refers to him as his father. And so Baldwin's mother marries David when Baldwin's just a toddler. And David Baldwin is someone who, from, you know, from James Baldwin's perspective, is somebody who is has really been, you know, sort of destroyed. You know, his soul has been sort of overtaken by hatred and despair. And I mean, despair is really the crucial idea, because Baldwin says, as he looks at his father, he sees someone who is constantly, you know, sort of experiencing a life of domination, right? He's dominated by his economic circumstances. And I sort of detail in the book some of the, you know, economic circumstances, what it was like to be, you know, in a family like Baldwin's in the 1920s and 1930s. He's obviously a victim of racism and feeling degraded by white people, you know, every day of his life. And so Baldwin watches his father, who, you know, his father's major outlet, his father's major way of dealing with his pain and despair is through the church. He's a Pentecost, he's a lay Pentecostal minister. And he's somebody who's devoutly religious. Jimmy, I'll just call him Jimmy for the time being. Jimmy says, just to differentiate him from David, Jimmy says his father is somebody who is, you know, the church provides him with a kind of a way of dealing with his pain, but his personal life is just totally destroyed. I mean, he says that basically his father has this devout religiosity that is clearly helping him hold, you know, himself together, but he's really unable to treat other human beings humanely. And so Baldwin watches his father, you know, really almost disintegrate before his eyes. I mean, he says his father's, you know, his soul, his mind, he sort of, you know, they basically fall apart as a result of the life he's experiencing. And Baldwin has a really, of course, you know, his father's a very authoritarian figure, and he really rebels against him in a lot of different ways. But he later on sort of recognizes that his father was really, you know, a victim of a set of circumstances that led him to this life of despair. And there's a really powerful moment for me as a father myself, when Baldwin says, just to capture the sort of how David was perceived by his own children, is, you know, Baldwin says that he can't remember a single moment when any of David's nine children were happy to see him come home, which is just sort of a heartbreaking line that Baldwin uses at some point in his autobiographical writing. And I think it gives you a sense of just the kind of the ways in which David was overtaken by despair and how that manifested himself, how it manifested itself in his relationships with other people. And so Baldwin really, you know, thinks about his own goal, his own task is escaping, you know, that kind of fate. I mean, he really wants to figure out a way to not become his father, right? In so many different ways. He wants to try to avoid that despair that consumes his father. And he wants to try to find some way out of you know, Harlem, you know, in general, but also just find a way out of that way of thinking, try to escape that way of thinking and find some other means of power. And so I think that's really crucial to understand, you know, as Baldwin himself, like he goes into the church when he's 14 years old, becomes a young minister. He's, you know, of course, raised in this devoutly religious family, finds refuge in the church as a kind of a way for him to escape some of the perils of life in Harlem. But then he leaves the church at age 17. And, but I think he sort of is, he always has his father in mind as somebody who, you know, he wants to try to avoid, you know, some of the things that consumed his father. And eventually, of course, he leaves the United States as part of his quest to do that. And then Buckley, so on the other side, right, this is a very different story. William F. Buckley Sr., is a oil and real estate man. He's made and lost and regained fortunes by the time his son is born, William F. Buckley Jr. is born. And Buckley Sr. is somebody who has very strong, he's a Texan, he has very strong views, and the views that are most relevant, you know, to the book. He's devoutly Catholic, and he's also devoted to a political doctrine he calls individualism. And basically, individualism in this context, he has in mind a you know, ardent defense of anything, you know, anti-collectivist, you know. So he's a critic of socialism, he's a critic of the New Deal, he's a critic of the welfare state, and he's a critic of egalitarianism. He's definitely a very suspicious of democracy. And so he really teaches his children. So the Buckley children are homeschooled for a great deal of their lives, and the family, you know, and they have multiple estates, you know, one in Connecticut where William F. Buckley spends most of his childhood, that they have live-in tutors, you know, that live on the estate to educate the children. And they also have tutors coming in, you know, part-time to teach them every subject under the sun. It's quite a curriculum. One of the things I describe in the book is the curriculum of the Buckley educational system. And so, you know, they teach them all these different things. They're basically preparing them to be, you know, elites who will play this really important role in resisting the excesses of democracy. Is sort of like, you know, it's very clear that the Buckleys are being taught that they are going to have a responsibility when they enter the public world to, to be the guardians of certain things that were might otherwise be consumed by the excesses of democracy. And so William F. Buckley Jr. doesn't ever seem really tempted by following in his father's footsteps into a career in business. But what he does decide at a very early age is that his way of honoring his father will be to be a defender of ideas that he believes, that his father has taught him to believe, have been so essential to his success, right? So William F. Buckley Sr. fashions himself as this sort of self-made man, and he would not have been able to achieve this, these vast riches and so on, if he was in a system that was collectivist, right? So there's a way in which William F. Buckley Sr. teaches William F. Buckley Jr., right, that he's got to go out there and defend this system. And that's exactly what Buckley does. So there's definitely a sense that you get in looking at Buckley's letters, to his father during his early years when he's at Yale and so on, that, he's trying to make his dad proud, right? He's out there defending the true faith, defending, not only his devout religious views, but also his very dogmatic political views. And so, in many ways, that contrast between Baldwin's setting as his goal, a mission to escape, the legacy of his father, Buckley is very much going in the opposite direction and trying to honor his father by protecting these ideas that he had been taught growing up.
Another similarity that we see, while they're still both relatively young, which is probably useful as well for thinking about the kind of international dimension of this book, is time they spend abroad. So Baldwin famously spends time in France. Buckley is in Mexico for a time, working for the CIA. How does that experience shape the way that they think about the United States?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that Baldwin, he feels a sense of, so after he's in the United States, he ends up leaving in the late 40s. His father dies in 1943. Baldwin sees one of his best friends, Eugene Wirth, commit suicide in the 40s as well. And Baldwin feels this sense of, despair creeping into his life. He'd also had this kind of especially traumatic experience living in New Jersey, and for the first time in his life being confronted with, white Southerners who treated him in a way. I mean, he experienced plenty of racism growing up in Harlem, but he said there was a kind of level that he was introduced to in those years that just seemed almost incomprehensible. He said, "I can't imagine what I could have done or what anyone could possibly do to deserve to be treated this way by another human being." And so Baldwin, feels this sense of, I need to escape, physically. I need to get out of this country because I will not be able to survive otherwise. And so Baldwin, like a lot of other black artists, decides to go to Paris. And he goes to Paris, without much, money, without a whole lot of, without a very strong network there or anything like that. But he basically, I think, believes that it's necessary for his survival. And also he hopes that as a writer, it'll help give him a little bit of critical distance that will liberate him to write about his experiences in Harlem. Because he said he just didn't feel like he could do that from Harlem. And he felt like he needed that distance from the country in general to be able to actually say something clearly about it. Buckley is somebody who, is also, on the move in other ways, as you pointed out. I mean, growing up, Buckley's family, as a result of, his family's various business concerns, Buckley is on the move internationally growing up. And that seems to have, some impact on him and sort of I think part of what's happening is that his father, as he's, kind of teaching the family around the dinner table, so to speak. I mean, I'm sure to point out ways in which places that they're traveling internationally are inferior, to sort of American civilization as William F. Buckley Sr. understood it. So I think that sort of plays a role in really deepening William F. Buckley Jr.'s sense of, kind of American exceptionalism. As after Buckley leaves college, and he spends some time in the CIA, as you mentioned, down in Mexico. Famously, I guess his supervisor down there was E. Howard Hunt, who became famous later for his role in the Watergate scandal. Yeah, that's a part of the story that's very murky, you know, in terms of, you know, precisely what Buckley was doing down there. There's a lot of speculation about what he was up to. But yeah, I mean, Buckley at that point is the biographical work that I've seen done that seems most detailed indicates that he was probably, you know, down there. Sort of the cover story was that he was looking after some of his father's concerns, but the reality was he was probably trying to monitor, you know, radical groups, especially radical student groups. And so, you know, that was a perfect role for him in many ways, because he was somebody who was so staunchly anti-communist and anti-collectivist. And so, yeah, I think that, and then Buckley, you know, he ends up being this kind of international traveler. He spends one of the reasons he ends up at Cambridge to debate Baldwin, or one of the reasons he was able to accept the invitation, was he was over in Switzerland doing his ski trip, where he would go ski a few weeks in Switzerland and write a book. Buckley, I think, is and he's obviously always engaged with this kind of international, you know, the international struggle, especially in the Cold War context. That's always something that's central to his, you know, his concern. So I think that, yeah, they're both in different ways. I think their international traveling plays a key role in their intellectual life.
So both men return to the U.S. in the early 50s, and a lot of meat of this book, in terms of thinking about the 50s and the early 60s, is their relationship to these emerging movements, these tandem movements. So you have the post-war civil rights movement and then the modern conservative movement. So let's start with Buckley, most obviously channeled through the National Review, but also seen in other ways. How does his relationship to both of those movements change, or perhaps not change, during this period?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think you're right to say that the meat of the book, the heart of the book, and sort of my favorite, you know, parts of the book in some ways are the, you know, the sort of mid 50s, you know, through leading up to the debate itself. I think there's just so much, so much rich history there, and so much that I think is, at least for me, was really helpful in understanding kind of, you know, where we trying to understand where we are now and how we got here. So Buckley, he graduates from Yale, writes God and Man at Yale, you know, this indictment of the institution. And then he writes the second book. If God and Man at Yale wasn't controversial enough, he decides, well, my next book will be a defense of Joseph McCarthy. And so he writes a book called McCarthy and His Enemies with a guy named Elbert Bozell, who was one of his college friends and debating partners, and eventually his brother-in-law. And they write this defense of McCarthy. They acknowledge that there's some criticisms of McCarthy's tactics. I think he's occasionally guilty of exaggeration, but they argue that McCarthy is a necessary instrument in the international struggle against communism. And essentially, they offer, you know, not a wholehearted defense of McCarthy, but a pretty strong one. But Buckley is frustrated. He's, you know, happy with the success of God and Man at Yale and McCarthy and Its Enemies, but he's frustrated with the glacial pace of book publishing. And so he wants to have more impact on the day-to-day politics. And so he ends up first trying to get a job, you know, working for one of the, you know, major conservative publications at the time, the American Mercury. And he discovers pretty quickly that he's not cut out to be anybody's employee. And he leaves that job after about 4 months. And what he really wanted was a magazine of his own. And he wanted a magazine of his own, in part because he saw that the Nation and the New Republic had played such an important role in shaping the progressive movement in the early 20th century. And Buckley hoped that he could play a similar role on the right and sort of help shape the conservative movement in the second half of the 20th century. And so he goes to his father and asks for a pretty sizable loan. And fortunately for Junior, Senior had the funds to provide it. And Buckley also proved to be a very, you know, successful fundraiser. And so, you know, it takes a little bit of time, but he's able to, the first issue of National Review comes out in November 1955. And it's important for folks to remember that, you know, that timing is really remarkable, and that, you know, 1955, of course, sees so many things. We see so many things that are so central to understanding that the next phase in the civil rights struggle, which is, you know, the lynching of Emmett Till, the arrest of Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott, all that's happening right around the same time Buckley founds National Review. And of course, the year before, the Brown v. Board school desegregation decision. So Buckley founds National Review, and he has in his mind, you know, that this magazine can play this really important role in shaping a movement. And so he, anti-communism, you know, he sees very, you know, that will be the glue that will hold the coalition together. And he invites libertarians, you know, so Frank Meyer is among the most prominent kind of libertarian thinkers that he invites on board right away. And he also wants to have, you know, sort of traditionalists that will be part of the coalition. So he invites famously Russell Kirk to be part of the initial crew. And Kirk's relationship with the magazine is a little bit complicated. We don't have to get into that. But basically, Buckley decides that he's going to try to bring together a coalition of folks. And also, he's going to play this really important role as a kind of gatekeeper. He's going to sort of decide who do we want to leave outside of the coalition. And so most famously, you know, he decides that Ayn Rand and her followers are too extreme in various ways, and their atheism is a big problem for Buckley, so they're not allowed out. Buckley has this kind of more complicated, long breakup with the John Birch Society that takes about a decade for him to really distance himself from the Birch Society. But he wants to develop a responsible intellectual coalition of people on the right. And so then the big question is, what is this magazine and that Buckley sees will play this role, he hopes will play this role in shaping a movement? Where is it going to come down on questions of race and civil rights, which are clearly on a lot of people's minds at the time? And what I say in the book, and this is something that, you know, I'm drawing on the work of a lot of other scholars in making this claim, is that it's not a foregone conclusion that someone founding, you know, a conservative magazine in 1955 would be hostile to civil rights. There of course had been the partisan story of, you know, attitudes for civil rights is of course a much more complicated one in those days than it is now. You have the solidly Democratic South as sort of the most intransigent faction on civil rights questions, and you also have another number of people who think of themselves as conservatives who are also, you know, supportive of civil rights to one degree or another. So people like William Noland, who Buckley invites, you know, to write one of the keynote articles in the first edition of National Review, is a good example of somebody who was supportive of civil rights, Robert Taft to some extent as well. So Buckley, though, decides that the magazine will be in a position of resistance. And that is a crucial decision that I think has implications that that end up reverberating to this day in terms of the making of the modern conservative movement. So Buckley, from, you know, from the very first issue on forward, wants his goal. He describes later, 10 years after National Review started, he looks back and says, "Our goal in race was to be on racial issues was to be extremely articulate, non-racist, but not reflexively accepting of racial egalitarianism." So Buckley is trying to be non-racist, but reject racial egalitarianism. And so that proves to be a really delicate balance. But he makes it very clear the magazine is against Brown v. Board. So they editorialize very quickly by calling, you know, Brown v. Board a judicial fiat, essentially saying that the federal government, not only the courts, but Congress as well, has no business intervening to try to desegregate in the South. He begins commissioning a number of writers. Richard Weaver probably is the most prominent among the sort of tradition on the traditionalist wing, who defends, you know, what he calls the Southern regime, the Southern way of life, which is very much, and Weaver is pretty explicit about this, is very much racial hierarchy is essential to that regime. He commissions James Jackson Kilpatrick, who's known as his biographer, William Huswick, calls him the salesman for segregation. And that's certainly what Kilpatrick was, the sort of squire of massive resistance in Virginia, who offered these kind of quasi-intellectual constitutionalist defenses of Jim Crow and of resistance and to attempts to desegregate in the South. And so Buckley, you know, commissions all these writers that are going to offer a variety of arguments and to resist the Black liberation struggle. And he, you know, he utilizes a lot of their arguments, these categories of argument, you know, in his own way. And then his own views come through crystal clear in one of Buckley's most infamous pieces of writing, an essay he wrote in 1957 called Why the South Must Prevail, which many listeners have probably checked out before if they've studied the history of the conservative movement, where Buckley makes a very explicitly white supremacist argument, saying that the proximate cause of the essay was the Civil Rights Act of 1957, was working its way through Congress, and it was being hollowed out of pretty much any meaning by the Southerners in Congress. So this is Strom Thurmond and Richard Russell and others. And one of the ways that they decided to really hollow out the Civil Rights Act of 1957 of any meaning was to say that instead of having federal judges consider questions of whether or not black civil rights were being violated, juries should decide. And essentially, the idea there, of course, would be that an all-white jury would be unlikely to ever find any Southern official guilty of violating the civil rights of a black person. So Buckley writes Why the South Must Prevail to defend this idea, basically, of jury nullification, basically. And he says that the reason this is acceptable is because white people are, for the time being, the advanced race. That's a quote from Buckley in that piece. And so Buckley, he ends up, every step of the way, the National Review is in a position of resistance to the black liberation struggle, with a couple of small exceptions. But Buckley is a little bit nervous about associating with some of the demagogues that have emerged later, but he's pretty comfortable associating himself with some pretty extreme elements, including the White Citizens Council. In 1958, Kilpatrick introduces Buckley to William J. Simmons, who is one of the leading Citizens Council figures, and offers Buckley the opportunity to have access to the White Citizens Council mailing list, 65,000 member mailing list, so that he might be able to get some more subscriptions for National Review. And Buckley accepts that invitation and has an exchange of letters with Simmons and phone calls, and they decide that it's perfectly acceptable. And the Citizens Council, of course, is Barry Rustin and others describe the Citizens Council as the uptown Klan, or the Klan with the habits of the Rotary Club, so very much in a position of a racist organization with the same goals of the Ku Klux Klan, but just different methods. And so Buckley, decides to work with these folks and never condemns any of their activities in the magazine or, in any public way. So that's kind of the story. And that, of course, develops over time as we work our way through the late 50s and early 60s. And Buckley will kind of adapt in various ways to whatever the latest controversy is, almost always a position of resistance. What is the best strategy to undermine the goals of the black liberation struggle? Even when he disagrees with means that might be used in one case or another by Southerners, he's absolutely with them on the same side of this in the spirit of resistance.
And in parallel with that, Baldwin is also trying to work out his relationship to both the black freedom struggle and also perhaps as a response to the emergence of the modern conservative movement. Do we see similar tensions in his activism or his work during this period?
Yeah. So Baldwin begins, he first covers the civil rights movement as a journalist, right? So he goes down to the South in the late 50s on assignment for a few magazines, including Harper's, sort of interact with people down there, including Martin Luther King, to interview Martin Luther King. And he writes a piece about King, and also to have the opportunity to engage with some of the folks who are on the front lines, both in terms of protest and also, one of the most powerful moments for me in writing the book. And I think my sense in just talking to people over these last couple of weeks, one of the most powerful moments for readers as well is right in the midst, as I'm going from these conversations happening, at National Review in New York, where these guys are sitting around figuring out precisely how to rationalize and intellectualize resistance to black liberation. Like right as those conversations are happening, James Baldwin is sitting in the living room of a 15-year-old boy who's one of the first black students to integrate a high school in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so just that contrast is to me just so powerful. And Baldwin, Baldwin's masterful at as he's whether he's writing fiction or he's writing nonfiction, he really, his goal as a writer is always to try to help his reader see the world through the eyes of the people that he's writing about. And so he's sitting there with this 15-year-old boy and just looking into his eyes and trying to imagine what it must have been like for him to go to that white school on that first day and be confronted with a barricade of white students trying to keep him from entering the school, and what it must have been like for him to be, you know, the victim of physical assault on a regular basis in that school. And so Baldwin is, he wants to understand, you know, from the inside what that experience must be like. And one of the things that he does in that same article that he writes about that 15-year-old boy is he goes from, you know, visiting with this 15-year-old boy and his mother, and, you know, also has these really powerful reflections on what it must be like for his mother, right, who in some ways, you know, sent him marching toward that white barricade by applying for him to attend that white school because she wanted him to get a good education, right? Baldwin goes from that meeting with them to meeting with the white principal of that school and sitting there with this guy and trying to understand what this must look like through his eyes and trying to get a sense of, you know, how he thinks through his role, right? What job he has to do and what that must be like for his soul. And Baldwin, I think, shows remarkable empathy for people like that principal. I mean, he says, you know, I went into the room, you know, in many ways wanting to hate this guy, but I found myself rather liking him and trying to understand the turmoil that must be happening in his soul. He's part of this system, right? He's in this, he's tangled in this web of white supremacy, and he, in many ways, can't get out of it, right? He still, even though Baldwin sort of likes him on some level, he still says this man is deluded, right? In terms of something, he's unable to see the humanity of this black child that he's been charged with in some way to protect. And so Baldwin, you know, writes these really powerful pieces covering the civil rights movement in that kind of way, really trying to get inside the head of everyone that he meets down there. And over time, though, Baldwin is trying to figure out his role in terms of he's increasing in prominence. He knows he has to go from, you know, being a witness, right? He often calls himself a witness, right? I'm here to write it all down. But he also sees that he has some, you know, duty to be more directly engaged. And so I think even his, you know, the writing that he does as a witness is a form of, absolutely a form of very powerful engagement. But Baldwin begins to try to sort of, like, you know, voice his own positions on a lot of these issues by the early 60s. And Baldwin's not somebody who's comfortable identifying himself with any particular ideology, with any particular organization. He does have, you know, special affinity for CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality, and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And so he finds himself occasionally, you know, engaging in those early years, in the early 60s, as kind of representative of nonviolent resistance, you know, on television and on the radio. You know, most famously, they have him appear, you know, opposite Malcolm X, right? And Malcolm kind of playing the part of, he's a critic in many ways of the sort of some of the early civil rights work that he finds to be demeaning for various reasons. And Baldwin is trying to defend in many ways what he thinks is the philosophical and political importance of the black liberation that we're witnessing in the early 60s, and trying to explain why this is different and why the world, we are on the brink of a revolution in many ways, a revolution in the early 60s, I should say, that Baldwin is quite hopeful about. But yeah, so Baldwin goes from that to, you know, eventually writing, you know, Letter from a Region in My Mind, which is published in the New Yorker in November 1962. And that, you know, he's already becoming, you know, a household name in a lot of ways. He's getting a lot of these pieces about the black liberation struggle and other topics published in more high profile places like the New York Times. And then with Letter from a Region in My Mind, you know, which is becomes this just phenomenon in its own right, published in November 1962, and eventually combined with a shorter piece, My Dungeon Shook, that was published in late 1962, initially by the Progressive magazine. Those two are coupled together in what would become the book, The Fire Next Time, which comes out in 63, which then, you know, Baldwin is on the cover of Time magazine and everywhere else. So Baldwin becomes second only to Martin Luther King in terms of the face and voice of the black liberation struggles. So yeah, Baldwin is like in the thick of this. He's not, you know, it's in terms of your, you know, part of your question was, you know, Baldwin also engaging with the right. I mean, Baldwin is engaging with the right in his own way, you know, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in not so subtle ways in some of those writings I just described. But he, I think another sort of really remarkable moment that was actually an archival discovery for me at the Schomburg, Baldwin, in his papers there, he has the full transcript of a debate that he had in late 1962 with the aforementioned James Jackson Kilpatrick, one of Buckley's closest friends and colleagues, in a lot of ways, the squire of massive resistance, the editor of the Richmond News Leader, one of the leading salesmen for segregation. Baldwin is invited in 1962 to debate Kilpatrick, debate segregation with Kilpatrick on the Open Mind television show. And it's just an amazing, amazing encounter where you have Baldwin sitting across a table from this leading defender of segregation. And it's right in the, like, within weeks, just after the battle at Ole Miss, when James Meredith, Black Air Force veteran, was attempting to register for classes at the University of Mississippi, and all hell broke loose, and the federal troops had to be called in, et cetera, et cetera. And Baldwin just starts that encounter with Kilpatrick by saying, "You think you are not responsible for violence that occurs, racist violence that occurs in the streets of this country, but I hold you, sir, far more responsible than any of those people who are actually committing those acts of violence in the streets." And so Baldwin does this remarkable, it's a remarkable takedown, of the segregationists on national television. And so that was in many ways, it's a couple years earlier, but it sort of sets us up for Baldwin eventually engaging with Buckley, which is something I should say that Baldwin's friends and handlers did not want him to engage with any of these guys. They thought it was a mistake for him to, share a platform with segregationists like Kilpatrick or somebody like Buckley. But Baldwin was absolutely, committed to the idea that he had a duty to confront these people and to try to expose them for what they were.
So in the first half of the 60s, as respective figureheads in different ways of these movements, Baldwin and Buckley are circling each other. And we're building up to, of course, the moment of the book, which is the debate in Cambridge. So how exactly does that debate come about? Is it just serendipity, or is it part of a more deliberate process?
It's serendipity, really. It's a remarkable thing. So, and this is one of the great mysteries. There have been, articles written and things over the years about the debate, but there hadn't really been, at least that I was able to discover, any clear explanation of how this happened, right? We all, the YouTube BBC recording of the debate had gone viral, several years ago, but there was not, at least that I was able to discover, a clear explanation of how this happened. So basically the story was, and this was, something that obviously those interviews I did with the Cambridge students and then the archival work, especially in the Baldwin archive, helped me piece together the story. So in 1965, late 1964, early 1965, the Baldwin's UK publisher was preparing to release a paperback edition of Baldwin's third novel, Another Country. And they wanted to saturate the media market, the media landscape in London and surrounding areas with Baldwin for about a week in early 1965. And so the publicist is reaching out to everybody, the Oxford Union, the Cambridge Union, obviously major media outlets and so on. And he contacts Peter Fullerton, who's this undergraduate, who's the president of the Cambridge Union. He says, it took a lot of courage to do this, but I said, "I'm sorry, sir, but I have to decline." Of course, one of the most famous writers in the world, an offer for him to come to your campus and to the union, and Fullerton declined. He says, "Well, this is a debating society. It'd be inappropriate for us to host a book talk. And so he says, "I would, however, be willing to host Baldwin for a debate if you'd be willing to come here to debate the themes of his writing." And so Collins, I think, kind of agrees, from what I've been able to gather from the archives, agrees to that in principle, pending Baldwin's approval. And without knowing what the motion will be, without knowing who his opponent will be. And so over the next few weeks, then it sort of things begin to develop. So Fullerton starts to figure out what would be an appropriate motion for Baldwin to debate. And Fullerton was familiar with Baldwin. He had read some of Baldwin's works, and he doesn't recall exactly, how he went about drafting the motion. But it seems clear to me that he had read The Fire Next Time, And I think The Fire Next Time was probably the closest thing to an inspiration for the motion, because the motion ends up being, you know, the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. And there's some really powerful language in The Fire Next Time about the American dream that my theory is that in some way might have inspired Fullerton as he was drafting the motion. And so then they're trying to figure out, okay, who are we going to get to debate Baldwin? They had a very short time period here. It was only about a month they had to get to pull this all together. And Fullerton's first idea was to invite a sitting U.S. senator to debate Baldwin. That wouldn't have been, you know, that unusual for the Union. They would often invite elected officials to come participate as honored guests in these big high profile debates. But Fullerton says their invitations were declined. There was no senator willing to share a platform with Baldwin, I imagine. And he doesn't remember exactly who they invited, but he thought probably people like Strom Thurmond, Barry Goldwater, who were either very hostile to or skeptical of the civil rights movement. So they're unable to find a senator to meet with him. And one of Fullerton's classmates and fellow union official, a guy named Michael Tugendhat, he says, you know, what about William F. Buckley Jr.? And at that time, Buckley would go on to sort of international fame. But at that time, Buckley was very famous in the United States. He was, you know, second in prominence in terms of, you know, conservative figures to only Goldwater. But internationally, he wasn't quite as well known yet. But Tugendhat had traveled to the United States in 1963 and was introduced to Buckley by a family friend. And so he knew enough, and I was able to communicate with Tugendhat as well as I was writing the book. And he doesn't remember how much he knew in terms of like how resistant Buckley was to civil rights, but he knew that he remembered that he was a formidable debater, that was part of his background, and that he was likely to be somebody who would disagree with Baldwin about a lot of things. And so Tugendhat was able to contact Buckley, who was at that time doing his annual ski trip in Switzerland, and he asked him if he'd be willing to come debate Baldwin. And of course, Buckley would never refuse a debate. You know, he was somebody who was constantly on the road debating and had written quite a bit about Baldwin to that point and referred to him as an eloquent menace. And so the idea of debating Baldwin must have been extremely appealing to Buckley. And so he agrees, and the publicist goes back then to Baldwin's handlers and says, okay, well, here's the deal. I have a debate set up for Baldwin at the Cambridge Union with William F. Buckley Jr. And a week before the debate, February 11th, 1965, a telegram sent by Baldwin's agent, Robert Lance, to the publicist at Corrigan Books. And it just is like maybe two sentences. It says, just learned of your plan to have Baldwin debate Buckley at the Cambridge Union. Please cancel it. And basically the explanation that the agent gave later on was that, this is one of those quotes that just sort of stuck in my mind over the months of working on the book, he says that Buckley is a master at getting under your skin. And so in order to deal with him, you have to be cool. And then he said, Jimmy is never cool about the world's problems. He is always aroused. So Robert Lance, this agent, said, there's no way I want my client to go share a stage. You know, and you know, at that point, they knew the BBC was going to record it, this international stage, a high-profile event. He was very worried about Baldwin being on the platform with Buckley. And so what's unclear is that, of course, we know, right, that was sent 1 week before the debate. The debate was not canceled, right? The debate went on. And so Fullerton doesn't recall anybody reaching out to him attempting to cancel it. So I suspect that probably some combination of things happened. One is that the publicist, you know, may have gone back to Baldwin's agent and pointed out, look, this has already been advertised. The BBC is coming to record it. You know, you might have a bigger PR problem on your hands if you cancel it. Second, I really, you know, and this is, there's not, I couldn't find, you know, documentary evidence of this, but there's, you know, enough evidence in terms of Baldwin's point of view that I think is a pretty, I feel confident making the claim that Baldwin, if he was CC'd on the cancellation telegram, and I suspect that Baldwin was far less worried about confronting Buckley than his agents were. And so, you know, like I said, when Baldwin was invited to debate Kilpatrick in 62, people tried to stop him from doing it. And he persisted. And I think that Baldwin, you know, knew what he was able to do with Kilpatrick. And so he went ahead and had this debate with Buckley. And so fortunately, you know, I think for a lot of reasons, you know, historically, but also politically, in terms of, I think, the power of the debate itself for all of us and thinking through questions of race and justice. Fortunately, the debate did go on, and they met a week later. And the debate itself, I mean, one thing I should mention is that many folks have seen the BBC recording on YouTube, and that is edited to fit within an hour. So what folks are getting when they watch that debate is they are getting the entirety of Baldwin's speech, which was 24 minutes long. It's very hard to figure out what to cut from that speech in a lot of ways, but they're only getting a portion of Buckley's speech. So Buckley actually delivers a longer speech, about 29 minutes. And one of the really, really cool archival, and this is not quite an archival find, but one of the really cool discoveries in this process of working on the book was that I, many others who've worked on the debate had this suspicion that something was a little bit odd about our documentary record. And then we had the BBC recording that is, you know, an hour long. And then we had what was the New York Times published, what they called a condensed transcript of the debate 2 weeks later in the Sunday magazine. And there are things in the condensed transcript that are not on the recording. So clearly there was like sort of this epistemological question of like, who said what, you know, and what's missing. And so I set out to try to find, you know, a complete recording of the debate. And the union itself did not have one. They said they have audio recordings of debates, but they thought that one was destroyed or lost. They didn't have it, so I was really bummed about that. But then, fortunately, one of the students I interviewed, a guy named Adrian Vinson, who was president of the union after the debate, the term after Fullerton, and he, as a president of the union, one of the privileges you were afforded was to request audio recordings of debates that occurred while you were a student. And so Vincent, fortunately, at some point requested recordings of the Buckley and Baldwin speeches. And so when I interviewed Adrian, he said, you know, I have an old reel-to-reel recording of the speeches. And so he was willing to ship those from England over to me in Portland, Oregon. I took them to one, you know, digital recording place here where they were unable to, you know, they weren't able to work with it. And so, I thought, this is horrible. You know, we were unable to, you know, capture what's on these reels. And then I found another digital recording expert who was able to digitize the debate. So we now have, for the first time, I believe, you know, in terms of, you know, for scholars, future scholars going forward, we have the full Buckley speech. The audiobook version of The Fires Upon Us has the full Baldwin and Buckley speeches included as an appendix. And the book itself has an appendix that includes a full transcript. So that will be available, you know, to folks for the first time, which we're really excited about.
You've been listening to New Books in American Studies, podcast channel of the New Books Network. A reminder that the book discussed in today's episode, The Fire Is Upon Us, is out this month, so consider picking it up at your local independent bookstore or wherever you get your books. For Nick Bucola, I've been your host James West, and we hope you'll stop by again soon.